So let's pray. Father, we're thankful for the great lunch and for the fellowship time over that meal. Thank you for the many people that have come literally from around the country and even other countries to be here on these 2 days, and even pray that as we talk about something that I think is critical for the home, I pray that you would give blessing, give great wisdom, and help us to honor you in our parenting boys. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right. I'm going to have to assume a handful of things with only an hour. I'm going to assume Genesis 1 and 2, that God designed the home in a particular way, gave Adam leadership responsibility in the home, in the garden, Genesis 1 and 2. I'm going to assume your understanding of Ephesians 5, where men are called to lead in the home, 1 Peter 3, Colossians 3, and then just the entire warp and woof of Scripture affirms a particular way that men and women are to relate to one another. So, in addition to my responsibilities here, I lead an organization called the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. You can go to our website, cbmw.org, and there are all sorts of articles and biblical arguments for why it is, or demonstrating that the Bible does teach that there are different roles that men and women are supposed to have in the home and in the church. And this is how we are going to be defining masculinity, femininity. So, I am going to assume those biblical passages and that the Bible does teach that in order for me to get into what I would call some very practical matters of how to go about doing a certain thing, and that in this case is raising masculine sons. Our culture has introduced an enormous amount of confusion on this issue of something as basic as what does it mean to be a man and what does it mean to be a woman. 50 years ago, who would have thought we would be asking that question? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And yet, largely due to just some cultural influences in the church, partially probably not paying attention, partially not sure what to say, partially because the church in some ways is being swept along with the culture, hasn't really said a whole lot about this or is just now really trying to regain some lost ground. And so my job today is to, or at least I've given myself the job today, to dig into what are we trying to do with our boys, what is it that what are we trying to accomplish, and then some practical ways to accomplish that. I hate these things that are connected because I get all tangled up. First question is, all right, so in those passages, what is God affirmed in men? What is their broad job description? Well, their broad job description, at least, is to lead, provide, and protect. Now, that's not exclusive. They have to obey the Ten Commandments and the fruit of the Spirit and all the one and others of the Bible and all that. But there's a particular context in which a man is going to live out his Christian life, and there are certain responsibilities that he's been given. And it involves leadership. We see that in the home and in the church, provision and just overall protection. I mean, who does in the Bible, who gets sent to war? The men. In fact, in the Old Testament, if you wanted to make fun of another country's army, you would say they send their women to war, because the Bible's affirming that it's men who are called to do these things, and particularly in our context, the home and the church. So, if this is true, and I'm assuming it is true based on my understanding of the passages that I mentioned, then the next level is to say, well, if that is true, and it is, then what kinds of things are we going to try to instill in our sons in order to be good at these three things? Character, toughness, resilience. You can make your own list, because the first thing in raising a masculine son is, one, you need to have what I would call a compelling vision. You've got to know what you're trying to achieve. You've got to have a picture of what you're trying to accomplish. What do you want this young man to look like when he's 18, 19, 20, 21, or whenever you think full-grown manhood occurs? What do you want it to look? You want him to be good at this, So then you have to say, well, then what kinds of things are we going to instill in him so that he will be good at these three things, and not just good at those things, but to have instincts and inclinations and some ownership that he, this is his responsibility. So it's not just that he's good at it, but that he in his own soul feels the weight and the burden and the necessity of this, of these responsibilities. So you have some qualities that you're going to have to instill, and then this is where the big time activity happens here. So what are we going to do in the home? What exactly are we going to do in order to instill these qualities in order to have our sons be able to do this, which if they're able to do these three things, then they're a man. They're embracing these things and they're able to do them. So you can have a compelling vision. Now, what I'd like to do at this point is to draw a little graphic here that explains a little bit, at least it's just in my layman's terms, on how a boy becomes a man. People make jokes all the time about how simple men are, just feed them, clothe them, you know, that kind of a thing. It is funny, and there's probably some truth to that. But the actual process of a boy becoming a man is quite complicated, and I'll show you why. All right, so let's say you have a mom right here, okay? And then we started off with boy-girl twins, so that's convenient for this experiment. So you have a girl, and you have a boy, all right? And then Dad is here, all right? So there's Dad. Now, for a girl to become a woman, in terms of who she identifies with and the natural process, she's born, she's very close physically with a mom. God's designed that, generally speaking, biologically even. She's close, and in order to become a woman, it's not to say the dad's not involved. That's a different discussion. But in order for her to become a woman, she really just kind of lines up with mom. And as she gets older, she just kind of stays with mom and identifies primarily with mom in terms of womanhood. And she becomes a woman. And it's a linear process. For a boy to become a man, this is why it's so complicated. This is why our culture right now is experiencing so many challenges with our boys and teenagers, and also just men who are kind of lost in the world. For a boy to become a man, he simultaneously has to do two things. He has to say simultaneously, I'm not this. Now, he's not rejecting his mom. He's just saying, I'm not her. I'm not a woman. I'm not this. I am this. And at the very same time, there's a separation that takes place that we're not tolerating disrespect, we're not tolerating dishonor, that's not what we're doing, but he has to say at the same time, I'm not her, I am. He's identifying less with her as a woman, still honoring her as his mother, but identifying less with her as a woman and more with him as a man or as a wannabe man. He wants to be a man, and so it's a break and attachment that happens. Well, you know, anytime you break and attach, there's a gap here that all sorts of things can go wrong. One thing can happen. Let's just say this guy's not here. All right? Well, we're living in a culture where sociologists would call it a fatherless culture. Dads are absent either physically or they're in the home, but they're absent emotionally. They're not there involved. And so maybe he's absent emotionally. Maybe he's literally absent. But in any case, if he's not there, then this process is challenged. I say challenged for a reason, because this campus is full of men. There are men in this room. There are men at this conference. Not everybody had a dad. It's not determinative, all right? It doesn't mean that if you don't have a dad, then automatically all sorts of horrible things are going to happen, because God gives grace in ways that sometimes we can't even explain. So I'm saying it challenges this process. That's the strongest word I want to use, because otherwise we don't know what God is or is not going to do. Maybe God brings in a substitute for this particular man, or the church rallies around. But I do want to say at this point, this is the point at which the church really can and should be rallying around these single moms who have sons in particular, who have no dad in the picture, this is where we can close the gap and do some unbelievable things for the lives of boys, because, man, it is much easier to bend a boy than to mend a man. Now, that's bumper stickers, and I didn't invent it, but it's true. Much easier to bend a boy than it is to mend a man. So he can, if this guy's not here, this can be challenged. Sometimes mom doesn't realize how soon sometimes this break occurs. And it can be disruptive because I'll just use my wife as an example. She kind of had in mind 14, 15, he's making the break. But that's not when it happens. It happens much earlier. And if you're not ready for it, it's unexpected, because at some point, I came home one time. Dana was in tears. I could tell she was down in the dumps. And what happened? What's going on? Well, Gunner was about 6 or 7. Gunner didn't reach up for my hand to hold my hand when we were in the store today. Oh, that's it. Oh, I thought somebody wrote graffiti on their house or something. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, it's happening. What's he doing? He's becoming a man. Now, he's not out there with an axe chopping wood and ready to provide for a family and all sorts of things. But see, it starts earlier than you think. He's becoming a man. Because, my mom's alive. We go places together and we don't hold hands anymore. All right? I'm just telling you, it stops at some point. All right? I don't hold my dad's hand either. That has stopped. Gunner, when he was little, he used to show up every morning when he was 5 years old. Every morning to watch me shave. Every morning, like clockwork. I could count on it. And, I was loving it. I knew it was going to stop at some point. I just didn't. I hadn't thought about that. And I just remember one day he didn't show up. I'm like, was he sick? Something wrong? Is he okay? No, he was done with it. He's blunt. He's just becoming a man. I'm not all that amped up about watching my dad shave anymore. All right. He's becoming a man. And so what can happen is mom sometimes can latch on. No, I don't want this to happen. No, he's too young for this to happen. Well, he's really not. Now, he's not disrespecting her. He still loves her, but there's a time and point where I've talked to other moms in this topic. For them it was, he didn't want to crawl up in my lap and watch TV anymore. He was 5, 6, whatever the age. He didn't crawl up in my lap and want to watch TV anymore. And it just dawned on me, yeah, I guess he's becoming a man slowly but surely. And so if she swoops in and won't let it happen, and just says, oh, no, you've got to hold mommy's hand. And, oh, no, you've got to curl up in my lap. And, oh, no, no. Well, again, it just challenges it. So I just want to point out how complicated it can be. If the roles are reversed, this is a killer. This is an absolute killer in a boy's life. If the roles are reversed, if dad is just passive, okay, and mom is very assertive, And she's actually the leader in the home, the whether spoken or unspoken. If the roles are reversed in that way, this causes an enormous challenge for a boy, because what we're talking about, this whole leadership provision and protection thing, is not just a mere sociological construct that just we do this in the United States. It's part of the created order, and since it is part of the created order that God designed it that way from the beginning, then I'm also claiming, God made the lion to roar, the dog to bark, the snake to slither. He's given them the equipment to do what they were made to do. I think God wired men and women in a way, such a way as to do the things and have inclinations to do the things that he's called them to do. So it's part of the created order. It's part of how he made us. So we inherently just know certain things, and we don't know why we know them. For instance, we all know that if there's a noise in the middle of the night, men, it doesn't matter if your wife is a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you go look at it. You don't go say, hey, how about you go check out that noise, all right? You just know, that isn't right, and maybe you go down there and you get whipped and she has to go down there and pick up the pieces for you, but she goes in second, not first, all right? And so we know that inherently. Why do we know that inherently? Well, it's not just natural theology. It's God made us to have certain roles and wired us that way. In a fallen world, it can get all jumbled up, and men can use their authority for ill and for evil and all sorts of things, and I recognize that. But there's still an inclination there, and it's why we instinctively know certain things and have a certain inclination, because that's the way God has wired us. And so a young man is wired to know and wired to want to be a man. Every boy wants to be something when he grows up. I don't know about their vocation, but every boy wants to be a man universally. That's what they want to be. And so he wants to be a man, but it looks like she's doing all the things that in his own soul he's inclined to embrace, the leadership, the authority. And so sometimes he'll hyper-identify with her and reject him. And again, it just causes challenges and sometimes confusion. So the vision is important. You've got to know what you're trying to achieve. And then and then secondly, which is why I drew the diagram, there's got to be modeling here with mom and dad. And because gender identity is inherent to who we are. It's central to who we are. So there are no generic people. You have male human beings and female human beings. And I know that there are some genetic anomalies along the way, but male human beings, female human beings. And in the Christian world, you don't have generic Christians. You have male Christians and female Christians, and they're going to live their Christian life in a particular context. One of those contexts is male or female. And so you've got to have some sort of modeling going on at home. And if you don't, it's going to be a challenge. So when people tell me, why can't you let a husband and wife pick the way they want to arrange their marriage? If she wants to lead, let her lead. If he wants to be, if however they want, why can't you just stay out of their marriage? Well, number one, this is a matter of biblical authority and obedience. But number two, it has deep and abiding impact on the children in terms of their own gender identity and gender, or their gender identity development. So, model it. All right. Number three. Authority is a bad word in our culture. A lot of people don't like it. Even Christians sometimes don't like the word authority. Forget about the roles. They don't like the government telling them what to do. They don't want the policeman telling them what to do. They don't want their employer telling them what to do. So authority, we sometimes have a bad view of authority, but God has placed authority structures everywhere. Everywhere. The home, the church, the government, Old Testament Israel, prophets, priests, and kings. I mean, there's authority everywhere, and God has put it there for our good. One of the things that that is important in gender development, gender identity, and raising a masculine son is that he is going to have to know how to submit to authority. A boy has got to learn how to submit to authority. Why? Because at some point, one day, he's going to have authority. He's definitely going to have authority in his own home. And by God's grace, he may have authority in his church. But either way, God's given him already an appointment of authority, particularly in the home in this case, and he's got to know what to do with it when he gets it. A person who's never learned how to submit to authority is not going to know what to do. They don't know what to do with authority when they get it. I mean, we've all worked for that guy, right? At Burger King when I was in high school, you know, or when you were in high school, you worked for this guy. He just turned 19, made assistant manager, and he's lording it over you like the Gentiles, right? He's just, like he's running the Pentagon, and he just got the assignment of his life. And he's flipping hamburgers like everybody else, but you're only 16, he's 19, and he is just taking it to you, giving you the taskmaster deal. Well, that's because this is a guy that has never learned how to submit to authority. He's got it now. He's been wanting it all his whole life. And he doesn't know what to do with it when he gets it. I want my sons and your sons to know what to do with authority when they get it so that they can honor God and picture the Christ church relationship in their marriage where he is lovingly leading his wife in a way that Christ would do the church for the good of the church. And so he needs to see good authority to know how to model it. He needs to submit to it as well. I will say something about daughters here. Daughters, of course, need to learn how to submit to authority. But the fact of the matter is, it's maybe for a little bit of a different reason. I want my daughters to learn how to submit to my authority because one day, in a very real way, I am going to walk, God willing, I'm going to walk my daughters down the aisle and I'm going to take her hand and literally put it in the hand of another man and symbolically, and maybe I might even verbalize it, she's all yours right now. I have been taking care of her and protecting her and leading and providing for her. I'm putting her hand in yours, and now that is your responsibility. And I want her to be able to make a seamless transition of submitting to my hopefully good authority, the way that I've been handling it, and now to his, because it's part of the harmony of the marriage. It's part of the beauty of God's good design, and I want them to accurately be able to portray the picture of the gospel. And so in order to do that, she needs to have an inclination in her own soul, in her own heart, to submit to my authority so that ultimately she can be that picture in the marriage and seamlessly just transfer that and translate that into under the authority of another guy. So, vision, model, authority. I'm going to go to this one. I'm going to call this one adventure and maybe even danger. To create, here's what I think has been very helpful in our home and in the homes of other guys that I'm in conversation with. This is not in the Bible, all right? There's no verse that says, hey, make sure you boys get into some danger and some adventure, all right? There's not. What I hope I'm doing is giving some, what I hope I'm doing is giving biblically faithful, what am I trying to say? Why can't I think of the right word? Examples, ideas on how to get at this level of training, because you can have all this, but if you don't have these things, it doesn't translate up. And so just some ideas and some practices that we've put into place. We have found it very helpful from very young ages for the boys is to start building into them this expectation, willingness to embrace a challenge, willingness to provide and protect and working that into their life. By providing some moments of adventure and danger. Now, the danger doesn't have to be real. All the danger has to do is be perceived. So, for instance, when they were little, we'd go hiking. One time in particular, Gunner and Georgia are about 6, Fisher's 4, and then we didn't have any other kids at that point, and Dana, we're on this trail. We're at the state park in Louisville. We're going on a hiking trail, and I get everybody together. Gunner and Fisher, get your pocket knife. Yes, sir. Okay, I got mine too. Now, here's the deal. Here's what we're going to have. If we're on this trail, if we see a bear, here's what we're going to have to do. Now, we're not going to see a bear. If I thought we were going to see a bear, honestly, well, I'm not going on this trail with 3 little kids, okay? We're not seeing a bear. There's not a bear within 10 miles of this place, all right? It's not Yosemite Park. This is Louisville, Kentucky, with a public trail where people throwing garbage and everything. There's no bear. But they don't know that. So we walk the trail. Say, Fisher, Gunner, we see a bear. I'm first. I'm the biggest, strongest. I'm going. I'm going in. Now, I've never fought a bear before. I don't know exactly if I've even got the right strategy. But if I go down, which is a big possibility, if I go down, Gunner, you're next, son. Now, you've got a good knife. Do what you can. All right? Fisher and his little knife, you know, yes, sir, he's 4. Yes, sir. His eyes are that big around. I said, son, look, that knife is not going to do any good at all. You might try to poke his eyes out. I don't know what you're going to do. Now, girls, while Fisher's getting eaten, you run like crazy. That's the story. That's what we're doing. Now, we're not seeing a bear, everybody, but what's already being determined here? The guys go down while the girls get away. That's all I'm trying to communicate. And trust me, their testosterone level was sky high, looking everywhere for a bear, just in case. And they're ready. And what that does, it puts a burden on their shoulders that's fun, that's a little lighthearted. I know they're not going to see a bear, but already at those young ages, what we're just putting into practice and inclining their hearts that this is just the way it is. When something bad goes down, the men do something about it while the girls get away. It's women and children first. I mean, this is all that kind of a thing. So it doesn't have to be real. We went camping one time and we were messing around and Dana's sleeping bag fell down in what all of us would probably just call a ditch. But that didn't seem dramatic enough to me. And I wanted the boys to go down and get it just as an act of courage to climb down there. So it was a ditch, but I called it a ridge. So, boys, that's a ridge right there. And I don't know what's down there. I don't know, snakes. I don't know what's down there. There might be a skeleton down there for all I know. Somebody trying to get down there and coming back. I don't know. I don't know what we're going to find out. Again, I hate snakes. I grew up in Florida. It's biblical to hate snakes. And I'm just telling you, I'm not going down there if I think there's a bunch of snakes, all right? But it doesn't matter. It's just perceived. And so we're going, that's Mama's sleeping bag. We don't want Mama to have to, you know, we're not sending her down there to get her own. You're getting it. So we climbed down there, and I made such a big deal out of this danger and what we were doing, and they were risking their lives, and we get up, and they're talking literally for 3 years. Dad, you remember that time we went down on that ridge? Oh, man, I'll never forget that time. Until one day, Gunner got old enough. He said, wait a minute, that wasn't a ridge. That was like a ditch. That wasn't anything. I said, I don't know, but it amped you up for like 3 whole years, didn't it? You didn't? You know, you thought you were a man for 3 whole years, and we didn't even have to do any real danger. You just perceived. So my point is, this has to be intentional. And what you have to do is either capitalize on existing moments or maybe create some, like we're talking about now, maybe, you know, create some. Here's my burden in this. Just across the, I don't know you, if you're doing this yourself, so I feel comfortable saying this because nobody in here should be offended because I don't even know you, but we are raising a generation of very soft, fearful, self-preoccupied boys that are going to turn into soft, fearful, self-preoccupied men. And a self-preoccupied man does not lead for the good of others. He leads for himself. Does not provide for others. Does not protect others. He's very preoccupied with himself. He's very soft. He doesn't care about others. And we are more preoccupied with our parenting in terms of safety and protection. Make sure nothing bad happens. How many times have I heard, oh, no, don't climb that tree? And the kid's saying, why not? Well, what's the answer? You might get hurt. Don't jump your bike. What are you doing? Why can't I jump my bike? It's like 2 feet. You know, it's not that I'm jumping my, why can't I do that? Well, you might get hurt. We are, just check your memory. How many times, now look, if they're about to climb off the roof of the house, I'm going to put a stop to that, all right? This isn't fraternity pranks, swallowing goldfish, jumping off the roof of your house, playing in the street with the busy. It's not just building machismo and, you know, who can do the craziest, toughest thing. This isn't Rambo or anything like that. That's not what we're trying to achieve here. But what we are trying to do is help them be what they need to be and instilling the qualities that they need. And they are not, you are not going to be a good leader, provider, protector if your first thought is, what if something bad's going to happen to me? Because men are supposed to lead and serve and protect to the point of self-neglect. We're made for the ugly stuff. We're not made for pretty. Look at y'all in here, all right? We're not made for pretty. We're made for the ugly stuff. We're made for battle. We're made to fix things. We're made to get into the smelly stuff, the ugly stuff, the war, just the ugly. That's what we're made for. And so if we keep telling, my fear is, if we keep telling our sons, don't do any of these things that are just normal, natural things. It's natural for a boy to want to climb a tree. It's natural for him to fall out. I can tell you story after story. I remember Fisher, I don't know, 7 years old. Dana called me and she said, hey, Fisher's out of the treehouse. It looks like he's got a rope attached to his waist. And I think he's getting ready to try to, like, fly. And she said, Do you think I ought to let him do that or wait till you get home? I said, well, wait till I get home because I just want to see this, all right? It's not because I think, I just want to see it. So he is waiting, sitting in the treehouse waiting I get home. And he's grinning he's got dimples. He's grinning ear to ear. And he said, you ready? I said, oh, man, I've been waiting for this all day long, my friend. And he's tied it up. And I'm letting him do it, okay? I know something is getting ready to go wrong. Now, I'm nearly positive this is not life-ending. All right, I'm not going to let him do something. I'm nearly positive that this is going to end bad, but it's not going to end permanently bad. So sure enough, he swings, and he miscalculated on the length of the rope. It was about 2 feet too long. So there was no swinging going. I was wham, bam. And I kind of had a feeling. That's why I came home for it, to see. All right, so what does he do? He gets up, dusts himself off, okay? And he learned a very big lesson. Learned calculate the length of the rope. He also learned you can fall down and get back up. And that's hurt, but I just got back up from it. This was last year. I came home, and I drove around the corner, and he knows I'm on my way home. He's standing on the corner, like in our, like four doors down from our house, waiting for me to come around the corner, and he's standing there grinning. You know why he's grinning? Because his knees looked like a crime scene. There was blood everywhere. I can't wait to hear how this happened. Blood everywhere, and he didn't even remove any of it. Okay, it's been there for hours. He's smiling. I said, "Man, what happened?" He said, "Isaac put a ramp in the cul-de-sac." Now, you men know what that means. You need no other explanation, because what that means is all the other kids, everybody's in their house playing Xbox, and Isaac put a ramp in the cul-de-sac, and there's a total disturbance in the force in the whole neighborhood. For every boy, there's a ramp in the cul-de-sac, and they walk out the door like zombies because they got to jump the ramp. It's there. You got to jump it. I needed no explanation. Oh, I get it. Isaac put the ramp in the cul-de-sac. I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "Dad, I got those rollerblades out, and I went to the hole under the other end of the cul-de-sac, and I went as fast as I could, and I hit that ramp. I bet you I was going 80 miles an hour." And he said, "I got in the air, and I thought to myself, I have made one big mistake." All right. See, it's the beauty of boyhood, isn't it? That he's going to be a man. He's going to be a man one day, and he's learning all sorts of things. First, calculate the landing. Because I said, "What was your mistake?" He said, "I didn't even think about how I was going to land. I wasn't even crossing my mind. I just wanted speed and air time was my main mission." And after that, so he wipes out. And so my concern is we're gonna keep telling him, "Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Just stay in the house and play Xbox, because then nobody's going to get hurt." And then our pastors and our churches are going to be identifying unreached people groups, and some pastor somewhere is going to be saying, "Listen, we found an unidentified people group. We've never seen them before. We need some single young men that are going to go there. We need you to scope the thing out. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what you're going to find. We don't know how bad it's going to be, how rough it's going to be. You may even not make it back. We don't know. But we're going to find that people group, and we're going to find out what they need. You come back and report to us, and then we're going to act accordingly." They're not raising their hand. No, no, none of these guys that we're training up this way are going to raise their hand. You know why? Because we've told them their whole life, "Don't do anything. It might get hurt. There might be a risk. Stay safe. Stay close. Don't do anything." They're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. We don't need prettier, softer boys. We need to be raising up men who are going to take the gospel into places that we have never seen, never heard, have never even seen another white human being from America. So, how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to have to be very intentional about our work in this area, giving them moments of failure, giving them even something as simple as, you know, we've never made a big deal out of the category of toughness. Just simple, what I call godly resilience, if you want to baptize it, but just toughness. You just fall down and get back up again. Fall down and get back up again. And I know I'm telling all these stories about Fisher. He's just on my mind in a good way today. Fisher, a couple of years ago, he dropped a piano bench on his big toe. And I mean, just, I heard him cry, and We've never told our kids, any of them, don't ever cry. And I've never told the boys, men don't cry, because that's not true. They've seen me cry. I've cried at funerals. The Little League World Series is going on right now, and don't try to explain it. But I cry when I see those boys make a great play. I tear up right in the living room. My boys have seen me cry at different occasions. I've choked up saying nice things about my wife in different venues. And so this is not a family. We're not saying big boys don't cry. No, men cry, but there are just certain things you don't cry about. Right? For instance, skint knees. None of you men are crying over skint knee anymore, right? The answer is right. We're not. Even if you're, just lie at this point, all right? I am not crying about. Of course, because at some point you know you don't cry over skint knee. And we're training our children, and boys and girls, just to be honest with you, just at some point, you know what? You're a certain age. You know how this works. So I asked Fisher, when he skint knees, my first question after he told me this, I said, "Did you cry?" "No, sir." Yeah, not because he never cries, not because we're not allowed to cry, but I'm teaching him that it should violate his masculine sensibilities at his age if he did, and it does. And no, sir. I mean, I might as well have asked him, "Did you smoke cigarettes today, too?" "Are you what?" "No." And so his toe, I heard him cry, and I mean, you just know your kids cry when it's nothing and when it is something. And this kid never cries. He's tough as nails. And I heard it. I'm like, "Oh, my word, something bad's happened." I go over there. It looks awful. I say, "Don't look at it." And then he says, "Is it coming off? Is it?" "No. Oh, no, you're going to be fine. Oh, no, everything's fine. It looks great." So I bandaged it up, covered it up. It was a mess. I really did think it was half off. But anyway, so we go to the emergency room. We wait there forever. We get back to the doctor. She takes a look, and she leaves the room. And I said, "All right, son, here's the deal. I'm always going to be truthful with you. Here's the truth. She's going to come back here in a minute." His toenail was off, just so, I mean, it's raw. And I said, "She's going to come back here in just a second. And she's got a shot. And she's going to stick that needle in right there where your toenail used to be. She's going to stick that needle in there probably 5 or 6 times. And it is going to hurt like a big dog. Now, about 10 seconds after she does that, you're going to be able to hit that toe with a hammer and you won't even feel anything. But the process to get there, this is going to hurt." And I said, "So, if you cry, you do not lose your man card. I would probably cry. This is going to hurt. There is no shame in it. If you cry, I won't tell your mama. I won't tell your brother. But just don't worry about me. You're still a man. All right?" So we're clear on that. I said, "Well, what you can do is why don't we just use the opportunity just to cultivate some just sheer raw toughness. And let's just see how long you can go without crying, all right? So grit your teeth, growl at your toe, do whatever you need to do. In 10 seconds, we're going to give you the award. It'll be a world record however long you do, because you're the only one doing it, all right? So we go there. She comes in, and sure enough, buddy, she delivered on everything I said she was going to do. And I watched him. He gritted his teeth, and you could just see. And all that happened was one tear just came down his cheek. And I thought, "Oh my word, he's tougher than I am. I mean, I'm getting ready to cry, and I'm scared of him now, you know. Oh my good grief." All right, but see, so she starts to put the stitches in, and she can't get the last stitch. And so it keeps tearing out. I know some of you are squeamish, but just can't get it. And all of a sudden, I keep seeing his toe like flick up every time she sticks that thing in there, and it flicks up again. And I said, "Fisher, can you feel that?" And she said, the doctor said, "Oh, he's been able to feel it for the last 5 minutes. She said, "I only gave him enough medication for just a few minutes. It wasn't going to take me long." She said, "I didn't calculate." She said, "He's been feeling that for the last 5 minutes. And then I thought, "Oh, my word, this guy's a machine." And so she finished. She said, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" Then I think I'm in trouble. She thinks I've scared him into not crying or something. So she goes, "I got to tell you something. The reason why you waited so long out there in the lobby is because for children that have these kinds of injuries, we reserve a room in the back here because it's away from everything, and the kids scream and cry, and they don't bother the other patients. And so we had to wait for that room. If we'd have known she said, "This is the toughest 10-year-old kid I have ever seen, and I have been in emergency room medicine for 20 years. She said, "You guys could have been in here like an hour and a half ago if I'd have known he was that tough. We were waiting for that room to come open." Well, what do you think it meant when I went to Fisher and just said, "Son, that woman right there said she's been doing emergency room medicine for 20 years and has never seen a 10-year-old boy as tough as you." So I'm not apologizing for that, because that is the kind of, he is compassionate. He and Gunner are the first ones. Well, this is not machismo, okay? This is masculine leadership, provision, and protection. It's for the good of others. So The same kid that can drop a piano bench on his toe and not even cry when he's getting stitches in there is the same kid, I assure you, is the same kid that goes to the youth group on Wednesday nights and intentionally befriends the kid that is being left out, that's not as coordinated, that is socially awkward, that is not being paid attention to. Gunner's the same way. So I want to round this out and say I'm emphasizing the toughness because that's where we're blowing it big time. All right, we are blowing it big time. And I emphasize this issue of danger and some adventure because that's where we're blowing it. But I'm not saying it to the exclusion of some of the other good things that we are instilling in them in terms of compassion and care and the fruit of the Spirit, which is gentleness, kindness, faithfulness, right, that are not for girls. Gentleness, kindness are for boys. It's fruit of the Spirit, not fruit of the girl spirit. All right, it's fruit of the Holy Spirit. That's for men and women. All right, so I want to round it out because this, it's for the good. All right, this toughness is not so he can go to his friends and say, I didn't even cry. No, I told him, don't even do that. It's not for you to promote yourself. This is just for you to practice doing something. You're going to have to do your whole life, but you're going to do it, and you're going to have this quality so that in certain times and certain places, you're going to be able to call upon it for the good of someone else. It's not for you, it's for others. And so it's others-oriented. It's teaching him to be not to be self-preoccupied, but to be others-oriented. And so that's the heart of the Christian life. And so what I'm trying to say is, on one hand, is that masculinity is imparted by masculinity. That's why it's such a challenge when this guy's not here. Why do you think gangs are so common and popular and on the rise in a culture that is largely losing the influence of fathers? Fathers are absent. Why are gangs on the uprise? Well, they do it all wrong, and they define manhood all wrong, but they're defining manhood in their own way, and they're getting these young men. What do these young men want to be? They want somebody to tell them when they're a man and if they're a man, and they'll hear it from anybody that's a man. It's got to be a man, but a man is telling them, hey, if you go conquer this many women, or if you go rob this bank or you commit this crime, then you're a man. They're redefining it. It's poorly, it's unbiblically defined, it's sinfully defined, but either way, they're defining it, and these boys in droves, just desperate, they want to know if they're a man. And so, it's an opportunity for the church to swoop in, but we've got to have a compelling vision for manhood. I'm going to be on a little bit of a rant, but we're losing our boys at 6, 7, and 8 years old. When an 8-year-old boy thinks that all the Christian life is about cotton balls and glitter, even though he's not ready to go lead a corporation or go to battle, something in his soul says, what? This isn't right. It's not about cotton balls and glitter. We have to have a compelling place for men, but we're losing the boys at early ages because as soon as they can, they're out. Because this seems so effeminate to them. And I'm not saying we got to camo up the pews and hang deer heads on the wall in our churches. That's not where I'm headed. Some people are doing stuff like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about let's have a robust picture of manhood and give our men some man-sized tasks to do and let boys go along with them and see that this thing is much bigger than a few little coloring sheep in Sunday school. So don't go home and tell your pastor he's got to restructure the whole church. I'm just saying, in your own homes, let's work on that. So, but manhood is imparted by masculinity. A man needs to do it. That doesn't mean the same. we were at a birthday party one time, and if you don't have kids yet, here's the rule: you get to the birthday party early, and then drop your kid off, and get out of Dodge, and go on a date. It's free babysitting. Don't get there late. Because then you get roped into chaperoning, right? So we get to this birthday party late, and sure enough, we bring the kid and whichever kid it was for, and then we don't have enough parents. Oh, great! So we're stuck chaperoning this thing, and so we're there. And this kid, he's going across the monkey bars in this family's backyard, and it's this high. He's hanging off. His feet are that far off the ground, so he falls and he collapses on the ground screaming like he's been shot. I've seen the whole thing. This kid is not hurt. He's screaming. I mean, literally, it was 8 inches off the ground, all right? So he collapses like he's been shot. The dad, not his dad. His dad is at Applebee's with his wife on a date. But the dad of the family that throw the party, he's running across the yard. He's hurt. He's hurt. And then he yells for his wife, Susie, he's hurt. He's hurt. And they go over there, and I'm like, that kid cannot be hurt. I saw the whole thing. I walked over there, and I said, Bob, move your leg. Can you move your leg? And he moves his leg, and I'm not a physician, but if you can do that, your leg's not broken, all right? So at worst, it's a bruise. So I said, son, you're not hurt. You're not hurt. And he stops crying, says, what? I said, son, you're not hurt. Get up, go get some lemonade, and play. He stood up. I mean, it was a miracle. I mean, come down here after the session's over. I got plenty of words for you. But and so I went back to my wife, and she said, what'd you say? I said, He had one man telling him he was hurt. He needed a man to tell him he wasn't hurt. He needed a man to tell him, son, I know what hurt is. This isn't it. I didn't shame him. I didn't embarrass him. I just declared it. This isn't an injury. Okay? I'm defining. How many of you that have little kids, you don't have to raise your hand, but how many of you have had this experience? It happens all the time. Kid falls down, and you know they're hurt, and what is the first thing they do is they look around, see if they have an audience. And if you see it out of the corner of your eye, you just turn your head, don't make eye contact, they'll move on, right? They just move on because, oh, this must not be a big deal. As soon as you turn over, say, are you okay? Why? You're defining, you're implicitly defining for them. You should be reacting in a certain way. And so even in those kinds of moments, you can help shape and say, that's nothing. We'll tell you when it's something. You know, you get bit by a dog next door, that's something, all right? But you fall off your bike, you 8 inches off the monkey bars, that's not something. That's nothing. And you help define it, again, especially for the boys. So Fisher, when he was about 4 years old, he went to the park with Dana, and she took a bunch of girls from the neighborhood and Gunner. And Dana brought a bat and a ball. She was going to have a little connect time with the boys. And one of the things for a young boy to master in baseball is catching a fly ball. So Fisher doesn't know how to catch it. He's four. He doesn't know how to catch a fly ball. They go out there, and he gets out there. Mom, hit me a fly ball. She said, Fisher, can you catch a fly ball? He's like every other guy. We don't even know if we can do it, but yeah, sure. So he's like, yeah, I can hit it out here, Mom. So she blasted a fly ball out there. And she honestly could not have more squarely put it on his eye if she had just walked out there and done it by hand. It hit him, bam, right in the eye. And so he's crying. Dana's recounting. He's crying. And they go over to the van. All the moms, you know, their radar goes off. And all the moms, that Dana doesn't even know. They come rallying around the van. And, oh, is he okay? He's okay. And, well, I think he's okay. And Dana says, I think I'm just going to take him and see his dad. And one of the moms says, What are you gonna do that for? What can he do that you can't do? Well, first of all, like, what if I was a neurologist or something? I mean, you don't know. I'm an eye doctor. Why would you even say that? There are all sorts of reasons why I could be doing something. But here's what I could do that she couldn't do. And this is where moms can big time help their sons embrace masculinity. It's to know. She's telling him it's okay. It's going in one ear and out the other. Not because he doesn't respect her, but because she's a woman and he needs to hear it from a man because he thinks he's lost his man card. He's wondering, is this even possible to become? I just got hit in the eye in front of a bunch of girls with a ball hit by my mama. I mean, what could be worse? What could be more emasculating to a four-year-old boy? So what does he want to hear? He just wants to hear, I can still be a man. Now, he didn't tell me that, but I've been a boy before, all right? And all you men in here know. You know how many things happen in your life where you just doubt, am I losing my man card permanently here? All my life, things happen. Even now, something will happen, and I'll think, oh, man, if I have to tell a friend of mine this, I'm losing my man card. But I tell them anyway, and they say, oh, no, that happened to me 20 times before, and you don't lose your man card. So men just need to keep hearing it. So Dana brings them up. I'm waiting. They pull the van up by my office. I'm waiting there. I open the van door. And I don't always get this right, but I'm telling you, I got it right on this time. Because I knew what he needed to hear. He's looking at me, and he's waiting for a verdict. He's just staring at me like, see it? I know. Mama did that. And he's waiting on a verdict. And boys, just don't overestimate or don't underestimate how often boys are waiting for the verdict constantly. And I just want to tell you, moms, if you'll, just as an aside, if you'll correct and encourage in terms of manhood, just something as basic as, hey, you just held the door open for your sister. That's what men do. Your dad does that. You're turning into your dad. Never make the dad be something bad to turn into. Don't never say, you're turning into your father. Don't ever do it. Even if he is, don't do that. It just is so discouraging for a boy because that's his only deal. If it's a bad thing to turn into that, then what else has he got? So it's always a good thing to turn into that. And you pray for your husband, and he turns into something to turn into. But until that, your father does that. And also, not to heap coals on the child, on your son, but you can correct in terms of manhood. You just hit your sister. That's not, men don't do that, son. Men do not do that. And now, in addition to love one another, in addition to love your neighbor as yourself and all sorts of other, add to it this element of turning into a man because it's compelling. When my wife says to my boys, that's what men do, it just, they think in their mind, oh, you think that's something? Wait till I do something else that men do. And just it makes them want to do it because in their soul. So Fisher's waiting for the verdict. And I said, let me tell all you girls in here something. Fisher and Gunner, I'm going to tell you something too. I want everybody in this band to know one thing. Fisher Stinson is the toughest 4-year-old boy I have ever seen in my whole life. He looked around and said, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. See? That's all it takes. Just words. Words. And it redefines it for him. This isn't a moment of failure. This is a moment of toughness. This is a moment of victory. I got drilled in the eye, and I said, you want to go look at it? Yeah, let's go look at it. Oh, they changed the whole thing. Just something as basic. It helped redefine it because I'm telling you, a boy can overcome broken bones. He just can. In fact, I'm not suggesting you try to get a broken bone, but it can be the best thing for him because they fall down, they break their wrist, they break their arm, it hurts. They go, it gets set, they realize they can come out on the other side of this thing, and in fact, medically speaking, where that bone was broken is technically stronger or will be stronger than it ever was before, and all of a sudden, you've got this object lesson and a reminder, I can fall down and get back up, fall down and get back up. And a boy, it's hard for him, he can overcome a broken bone. It's very difficult to overcome overprotection, being overmothered, underfathered, it's a challenge. And many, many, many men are carrying around just hidden burdens and challenges because of those things. It's not insurmountable. If you grew up like that, God can restore the years that the locusts have eaten. God can redeem you in Christ and can put people in your life to help you work through all sorts of challenges. So this isn't about that. This is just about being proactive and encouraging things to go on in our churches that inspire these boys to want to become men and want to become godly men and want to become men of the cross and men that are gospel saturated, that they don't think that they have to check their masculinity at the door to become a Christian. All right. Are we supposed to be done at 2? Something like that. How many of you are going to the eHarmony thing for pastors? Okay, all right, good. All right, so I'm going to, that's it too. If you guys want to take off, that's fine. I'm just going to does anybody want to ask a question too? And y'all feel free to go because I don't want to hinder your career changes. All right, yeah. Yep. Are you saying that maybe we've lost something by losing RAs and?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my church is a kind of
classic Yeah, absolutely. What happened is somebody decided to not do RAs, but then not to replace it with something that if they thought RAs was outdated, and I'm sure there are things that, you know, that we need to, I mean, it's GAs too, and Girls in Action doesn't mean quite the same thing today as it used to with, so there are all sorts of things with that we would have to change. But the fact is, there has to be something that the church is intentionally doing, and what RAs and pioneers and others used to do in terms of backpacking and giving these boys some sort of experiences that connect with their masculinity, we didn't replace it with anything. And so I do think we've lost something. I think that, I don't know what the solution is, but I do agree with you that especially now in the absence of so many fathers, having some structured things that these boys can do in a group setting with some other men who are pouring into their lives are needed more now than ever before. So I'm in agreement with you. I don't know what the solution is, but I do think that we've lost something there that needs to be regained somehow. Yes, sir.
Just your thoughts on thoughts on practical, I guess, sort of milestone. I was looking at the Robert Lewis raising the Matter Day Bank and those sorts of things for fathers to do with their sons. I wonder what your thoughts are on.
Yeah, Robert Lewis has a great book called Raising Modern Day Knights, and it's how to kind of commemorate your son's passage into manhood, and the imagery is great, the knighthood imagery, and the process is great, getting some men together for the ceremonial time, men speak into the lives of this young man and encourage him to be faithful and pure and all sorts of great, so fantastic. We've done a modified version of that in our home, and we've picked out a lot of different milestones, so you know, when the boys got their first BB gun, you know, this is a little, we didn't have a ceremony, but it's just, all right, you know, you were too little of a boy before, now you're moving, now you get a BB gun, their first rifle. When the birds and the bees talk, that was a big commemorative kind of a weekend trip that we did. And because again, now what I'm saying is this information, little boys don't get this information. Now you're in the world of men. Now you're at the table with men. It's not time for you to start talking with the men. All right, you're still a listener. You're still a learner. You're 12 years old, but you have a seat at the table with men now. Men know this stuff. Little boys don't know this. And my kids aren't driving yet, but a driver's license, you know, those, a different achievement. Gunner and Georgia are in ninth grade, but it's a long story. They're taking a couple of classes at a college here on campus, and so that's a moment. You're moving into a different realm here. You're not with little kids anymore. You're with older kids, and here's how we're going to. So we've tried to just the ceremonially, it's the birds and the bees talk for us. Whenever the kid is ready to hear that, that's when I think they're ready to start seeing themselves as a young man or a young woman moving into full womanhood or manhood. So that's more ceremonial. But we try at every turn to acknowledge this represents movement in your life toward manhood and womanhood, but movement in your life. You know, you've accomplished first mission trip, first for Gunner. Gunner had an opportunity to go deep sea fishing, and I couldn't go. And so a friend of mine, but Gunner's first time navigating. I mean, I put him on a plane. And he flew down to West Palm Beach to go deep sea fishing with Jimmy Scroggins, who's here. By the way, Gunner caught a 7.5-foot, 84-pound sailfish that it takes up half this wall. We're actually getting it to hang on Gunner's wall in November. But so, you know, his first time navigating an airport by himself. This was a big talk we had about responsibility and things. And now, so I'm all for these passages because we are lacking this in our general American culture. We don't, and that's why boys are 28 years old still trying to make a living playing Xbox, and they don't know that they're still being a little boy. You know, they haven't had anybody marking them and saying you're getting there, and let them know you are there. So yeah, I think we ought to just do a lot of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's no more than 3 hours a day. I'm just kidding. Yeah. a friend of mine came up with this idea. We've got 7 kids. We've got an Xbox, and I think it's fun. There's some fun stuff on there. So I'm not saying throw that in the garbage, but every kid gets 3 30-minute passes. It's a little square that says pass on it with their initial. That's it. And so they get 3 30-minute passes, and they still have to ask, but I don't have to keep track of, how many hours have you been? Everybody gets an hour and a half, 3 30-minute segments, and it's like cash. You burn it up, you burn it up. You use it on Monday and Tuesday, you're done for the week. You lose them. When I lose cash, the bank doesn't make it up for me, and so you lose that pass, can't find it. You have to wait until Saturday, and you can make a new one. Now, I will tell you a funny story. So it's very minimal. We don't have a pass for the television because typically we're watching it as a family, and it's Discovery Channel or Little League World Series or and sports. But we just have a pretty good balance, I think, at least in my estimation, on the TV. But the game system, that's it, an hour and a half. You can play it when the sun's out. You can play it when it's raining. You get 3 30 minutes, and that's it. And so that has worked. Everybody knows it. I will tell the story of my 10-year-old daughter, Peyton, who 2 years ago, I went upstairs, and The pass is a little just square piece of paper that, you know, everybody cuts out by hand. I go up there, and she's cutting paper about the size of the squares that are the game pass size. And I said, "Peyton, what you doing?" "Just sweet. I'm just cutting paper, Daddy." She's got a whole counterfeit operation going on in there. He ain't just cutting paper. You know, so she was trying to work the systems that we figured that out. But that's it. Like, man, get your kids outdoors.
What are the other kids doing? Are they watching?
Oh, can they? Right. They have to ask, and it's just up to me or Dana. You know, sometimes Spencer, you know, he'll say, "Dad, can I go watch Fisher play, you know, Major League Baseball?" And, you know, I'll say, "Yeah, okay." You know, but normally it's not. Normally, if you go down there, you got to use a pass in the basement. I say down there, it's in our basement. You got to, you know, if you're going to, but sometimes, and every now and then, because I'm a benevolent father, I'll just declare free pass day today. And if you're out of passes, you get one free pass today. Just go. If you want to go, just whatever. Just if I'm feeling particularly happy and like I'm a good dad, you know. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. I hope this was helpful. And thank you for just being here at the conference. Grateful you guys are here. Yep.